If you would please open your Bibles to Luke's account. We're going to be following several of the accounts in our study tonight. Let's start in Luke's account in Luke the 22nd chapter. Luke the 22nd chapter. These accounts, of course, give us a narrative. Some of them give us more details than others. And we'll begin with Luke's account in the 22nd chapter. I want to begin the reading in verse 47. Verse 47. While he yet spake, behold, a multitude, and he that was called Judas, one of the 12, went before them. And he drew near unto Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said unto him, Judas, betrayest thou the Son of Man with a kiss? And when they that were about him saw what would follow, they said, Lord, shall we smite with the sword? And a certain one of them smote the servant of the high priest and struck off his right ear. But Jesus answered and said, Suffer ye them thus far. And he touched his ear and healed him. And Jesus said unto the chief priest and captains of the temple and elders that were come against him, Are you come out as against a robber with swords and staves? When I was daily with you in the temple, ye stretched forth not your hands against me, but this is your hour and the power of darkness. And they seized him and led him away and brought him unto the high priest's house. But Peter followed afar off, and when they had kindled a fire in the midst of the court and had sat down together, Peter sat in the midst of them. And a certain maid, seeing him as he sat in the light of the fire, looking steadfastly upon him, said, This man also was with him. But he denied, saying, Woman, I know him not. And after a little while, another saw him and said, Thou also art one of them. But Peter said, Man, I am not. And after the space of about 1 hour, another confidently affirmed, saying, Of a truth, this man also was with him, for he is a Galilean. But Peter said, Man, I know not what thou sayest. And immediately while he yet spake, the cock crew. And the Lord turned and looked upon Peter, and Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how that he had said unto him, Before the cock crow this day, thou shalt deny me thrice. And he went out and wept bitterly. And the men that held Jesus mocked him and beat him. And they blindfolded him and asked him, saying, Prophesy, who is he that struck thee? And many other things spake they against him, reviling him. And as soon as it was day, the assembly of the elders of the people was gathered together, both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away into their council. If thou art the Christ, tell us. But he said unto them, If I tell you, ye will not believe. And if I ask you, ye will not answer. But from henceforth shall the Son of Man be seated at the right hand of the power of God. And they all said, Art thou then the Son of God? And he said unto them, Ye say that I am. And they said, What further need have we of witnesses? For we ourselves have heard from his own mouth. And we'll pause there in that reading. And look at some of the other accounts as we go through this. The key that I want to focus our attention on, and I read all of that so that you could get the setting of Jesus being arrested and the mockery and so forth that was taking place. And many of these things, of course, the other accounts as we've studied last week, took place during the night, which were illegal practices according to Jewish law, and we noted that last week. But in verse 66 is where I want to begin our thoughts tonight, as soon as it was day. So now we are beginning somewhat of the official hearing before the whole Jewish court, the Sanhedrin court, in formal session as Jesus is led into their midst. We know that they're seeking false witnesses, but at this point there wasn't any. And according to our study last week, we noted that according to the Jewish law, not only their Jewish tradition, but even the law of Moses required the testimony of at least two or three witnesses before even charges could be filed. Now, that's modern terminology, of course. We understand that. But official charges had not been made during the night, and Jesus has endured all of that. But in Mark's account, it says immediately in the morning, the chief priest held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council, and they bound Jesus and led him away and delivered him to Pilate. That's the New King James translation. And the reason why that's so important to us is this is essentially the transition from the Jewish portion of the trials of Jesus to the Roman portion of the trials of Jesus. Now, we noted last week that the Jewish portion of the trials had really two steps to it. He was taken before Annas, and then he was taken before Caiaphas. And the Roman portion of the trial essentially has two elements to it as well, as Jesus is taken before Pilate and then brought before Herod. Now, we need to talk about those characters, and we will do that. But then, of course, we know that he was brought back to Pilate, where Pilate then made the final judgment of his execution. But now we're beginning what would be on our calendar Friday morning, the time of this trial before the court proceedings. On this chart, I simply want to note, if thou art the Christ, then tell us. The other accounts record some information that I think worthy of note. When we look at John's account in the 18th chapter of the Gospel of John, beginning in verse 19, John 18, verse 19, there the text tells us, the high priest therefore asked Jesus of his disciples of his teaching, and Jesus answered him, I have spoken openly to the world. I ever taught in the synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together. That's interesting to me, because what we want to note is Jesus had done nothing privately. The claims that he had made, the teaching, had all been in a public forum as far as these accusations now are concerned. And Jesus points that out to this man. But not only John 18 helps us a bit with this, but if you'll turn back to the text of John chapter 10, now, the timeliness of the writing of John comes to play in this. We said that the last week of Jesus' life, according to John's account, begins in what chapter?
12.
Chapter 12, that's right. So we're just prior to that when we're studying here in John chapter 10. And if you'll recall the reading from verse 22 of John 10, it says, it was the feast of the dedication at Jerusalem. It was winter. And Jesus was walking in the temple in Solomon's porch. The Jews therefore came round about and said unto him, how long dost thou hold us in suspense? If thou art the Christ, tell us plainly. Now let's pause right there. Had Jesus not told them plainly on numerous occasions? In fact, as you go back to John chapter 8, John chapter 4 and 5, when he's speaking to the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4, she said, I know that Messiah cometh, and when he comes, he'll tell us all things. Jesus said, I that speak unto thee am he. Is that not plain enough? And in John chapter 5, if you'll note in verse 30, a similar statement is made. John chapter 5, verse 30, the text says, I can of myself do nothing, as I hear I judge, and my judgment is righteous, because I seek not mine own will, but the will of him that sent me. We key in on that for a reason, because who is Jesus claiming that sent him?
God.
God did. So he's claiming to be the Son of God when he makes this statement. And then again in John chapter 8, you're familiar with this, in John chapter 8 and verse 58, the reference is to Abraham, and Jesus said, before Abraham was born, I am. Well, did they understand what Jesus had said? Oh, yeah, they got it. He's claiming to be God. That's plain enough they got it. John chapter 8, verse 24, prior to that, you'll notice he said, for except you believe that I am. And of course, we see the word he is in italics. They're familiar with that statement, I am. We see that in Exodus chapter 3 when God appeared to Moses and identified himself. I am that I am. Now the Jews got that. They're familiar with that expression and they know what Jesus is saying because, as Richard said, they want to take up the stones and kill him. They've got it. They know exactly what he said. But now why do we see the statement John 10? If you're the Christ, why don't you tell us plainly? How much more plain could language be? And now, of course, in our text of John chapter 18, verses 19 through 21, the same thing. If you're the Christ, why don't you tell us? Now they're about to crucify him for claiming to be the Christ. Is it something that's so ambiguous in his statements that they haven't understood him yet? They've attempted to kill him on a number of occasions for making that claim. Now make the statement, if you're the Christ, why don't you tell us? Jesus said, I've been preaching and preaching and preaching and preaching openly in the temple. Why don't you ask the people that I've been preaching to?
Also in John 10, verse 36, he said, do you say of him who the Father sanctified and sent into the world, you are blaspheming because I said I am the Son of God?
Yeah, he said it. Yeah, Carol?
And back in Luke where you were before, Luke 22:67, when they say, tell us, he says, if I tell you, you will not believe. And of course, they didn't believe over and over and over. They refused to believe.
Same thing in John 10, which was an earlier place in his life. He said, I told you, and ye believe not. The works that I do in my Father's name, these bear witness of me, but you believe not, because you are not of my sheep. My sheep hear my voice. Well, the simple point that we've established time and time again in our study of the Gospel of John is, I am the good shepherd, and my sheep hear my voice. And we've noted that repeatedly, that as long as the sheep continue to hear his voice and follow him, then they'll be saved. But if they're not listening and they're not following him, then they're in jeopardy. And that's the point that's made throughout the 10th chapter. But it's not because he hasn't told them plainly. Repeatedly he's told them plainly. Linda?
I believe that because that they are holding court, as it were, that they want him to, what they consider, blatantly blaspheme. So that they can say, aha, see, he deserves it.
Yeah, and whatever is said, they're going to construe it into that blasphemy. But yeah, it gives their charges some validation if they can get him to incriminate himself. And, of course, some of the things that they charge him with, we'll look at a little bit later. I've got a chart on that. They have to twist what he has said to even come up with these charges. And so we want to take note of that. But this is how the day starts. If thou art the Christ, why don't you tell us? Well, I've told you, and if I tell you again, will it make any difference? And that's his point in the following verses here of Luke 22. You see, the point is, from this point going forward, I'm going to be on the right hand of God. How can you miss that? Those of you that are studying with us on on Tuesday night in our Hebrew study. Remember very well the comments that we've made about the prophecy of thou shalt be on my right hand, and your priesthood would be after that of Melchizedek. We saw that in Psalms 2, and then again in our study in Psalms 110, where he would be seated and the significance of that. He's telling them here in the trial, from here forward, I'm going to be on my Father's right hand. And they said, art thou then the Son of God? And he said unto them, you say that I am. And why would they say that? You pointed out last week, Randy, he had said that on a number of occasions. But this is the charge that they're setting forth. And they said, what further need have we of witnesses? For we ourselves have heard from his own mouth. And the whole company of them rose up and brought him before Pilate. Now this kind of marks the end of the Jewish trial, the two phases of the Jewish trial. The Sanhedrin, they don't take long to convict him, do they? And why do you suppose that's true?
They already made up
their mind. Yeah, it's just kangaroo court. And they know that they can't convict him without the rubber stamp of Pilate, so they bring him before Pilate. So here's the picture. Jesus has been up all night. He's had this abuse, being bound, spit on, slapped, struck in the with the fist while blindfolded, and then said, "Prophesy, tell us who hit you." And all of these things, this is the night that he had before this Jewish court trial, before the Sanhedrin court. And so then when questioned by Annas, Jesus told him to question those. "I've been in the temple. You ask those that I've been teaching. And you'll know. I won't have to answer it myself." And we talked about this last time. When adjured, he confessed his deity. And these so-called trials, when he was taken before the rulers of the Jews, he opened not his mouth. He opened not his mouth. Well, Isaiah had prophesied about that, and we've already examined that from Isaiah 53. Now, let's get to the Roman part of this trial. In our study last time, we just introduced this, and I think that it's worthy of more comment. I've worked on this just a little bit more to identify who Pilate is. He was appointed the fifth governor of the Roman province of Judea, Samaria, and Idumea, serving under the emperor Tiberius Caesar. Most that I've read date it from about 26 to 36. Some vary the dating from 27 to 37. But that gets us the time frame. And the thing that I want us to see in that is not necessarily to be absolutely certain what year, but to know who. That here is a man who has been appointed as a governor of the province of Judea, in particular, where we're reading about this trial, by the Roman emperor. And what kind of a man was he? Well, we might just out of the chute assume, being as he is an appointee of the Roman emperor, he's probably not a very nice fellow. But be that as it may, let's look at what we know. What we know is that he hung worship images of the emperor throughout Jerusalem, and had coins bearing pagan religious symbols minted. Now, many of those are available even today by collectors, so we know that was done. And here's the man that kind of began to instrument that in the city of Jerusalem. Now, if you were a Jew in the city and you have to do business with Roman coins that have the inscription of an emperor or an idol, pagan god on it, would that be something you would enjoy having to do? Well, probably not. And then to have the images of the emperor hung around through what we will call the sacred city of Jerusalem, that would be offensive. And then the standards that the soldiers carried were in the likeness of the emperor. So almost around every corner of the street that you would turn, you would find something to impress you with the emperor in the city of Jerusalem, or idol worship or emperor worship in the city of Jerusalem. Now, as a Jew, would that go over well? Well, no, you wouldn't. You certainly wouldn't like that. And then to consider the character of this man, he took money from the temple treasury to build an aqueduct to Jerusalem. Now, sometimes we think that politics is something new, and robbing Peter to pay Paul, so to speak, and we think, well, you know, we've got all this money over here invested, and the government gets their hand in our investments and uses it to do things that we don't have any control over, and we don't like that, do we? And we call that politics. Well, there's not anything new to that. It's what Pilate was doing. He had a project, and he took the temple money to build the aqueduct to Jerusalem. He put golden shields inscribed with portraits of the emperor in Herod's palace. And we'll talk more about that. But he mingled the blood of some Galileans with their sacrifices. We talked about that last week. And why did he do that? And we asked the question, was it because those that he killed were worse offenders than anybody else? Well, no. It's just me. My dad, I remember growing up, I'd ask him a lot of questions about why people did some of the things that they did. And his response to that said, well, some people just mean. They just don't care. Now, do you believe that's so? Some people just mean. They have no real conscience. They're seared over, and so they do what they want to. Just plain mean. And I would suggest to you that Pilate is a character like that. He's not interested in anybody but himself. And just a very worldly man. And that's not all either, because we read about Herod Agrippa I. He charged Pilate with corruptibility, violence, robberies, ill treatment of the people, grievances, continuous executions without even the form of a trial, endless and intolerable cruelties. Now, question. Just on the premise of what you know about Herod Agrippa I, and he's charged Pilate with these atrocities, what's that tell you about Pilate?
Really bad.
He really bad. He's not a very nice guy. But he's the man that Jesus is presented now before as the Roman authority to make the decision on whether or not Jesus lives or dies. Others tell us that he slaughtered and imprisoned many of the Samaritans gathered at Mount Gerizim to search for artifacts. And the Samaritans reported Pilate to Petilius, legate of Syria, after the attack, and he was ordered back to Rome, stand trial for cruelty and oppression. Now, let's pause this there. Here's the man that the Caesar has appointed to serve as governor over the province of Judea. And because of his atrocities, he gets called back to answer for these things. Again, I would ask you, what does that tell us about this man, Pilate, who is in charge now of what's going to happen to Jesus? He's not a very nice guy. Pilate was replaced in 36 A.D. and returned to Rome. One source told me that he was eventually exiled from Italy and died in 38 A.D. I found another source that said that Pilate killed himself on orders of the Emperor Caligula. Killed himself because the king told him to. Now, this is how bad of a character he was. Now, I don't know. Maybe you all knew all about Pilate before we started this study. Some of these things I'd studied in the past but just forgotten. But we need to be reminded of who this man is. What kind of a character he is. He's not a very nice guy. And then we look at his question to Jesus, what is truth? More on that later. But does the background of this man give any credibility to him as far as his concern for what truth really is? Well, he don't care what truth is. That ain't never to him. The only reason he's giving the order, as we'll see in just a moment, to execute Jesus is because that's what the Jews wanted to do. He don't care about Jesus. He don't care about what's right, what's wrong. Now, granted, we see some efforts on his part to release Jesus, but why does he then say, "See ye to it? Go kill him." He saw that a tumult was arising. I'm going to get crossways with the people if I don't do that. So, as Gamaliel had said, it's best for one man just to be executed, whether he's righteous or unrighteous. Just go ahead and kill him and solve the problem of the turmoil among the people. And we think politics is new. We think ill treatment of somebody, a lack of equity or justice, that's something that's new. That's always been. That's just old hash. And that's what we have here. Of course, what we have here is not just the character of the men, and I find this kind of a fascinating part of the study, but the providence of God, how that God's plan was carried out, how it came to pass. Do you think that Pilate in any way, or the Jewish court in any way, would have facilitated in carrying out the plan of God if they knew that's what they were doing? Well, no. But no, that's what we've got. That's what we've got. Well, let's look a little bit further. We know that Jesus is brought to the Praetorium before Pilate. He went out to the crowd to learn what the charges are. Let's read it again. John chapter 18, beginning in verse 29. It tells us that Pilate therefore went out unto them and saith, "What accusation bring ye against this man?" Look at your Bible. "And they answered and said unto him, If this man were not an evil doer, we should not have delivered him up unto thee." All right, now look at the question. What is it that Jesus has done? What accusation do you bring? And what's their evidence? Well, we wouldn't have brought him if he wasn't guilty of something. Isn't that about it? We wouldn't have brought him to you if he wasn't guilty of something. Yeah, so our word takes precedence over anything he can say. You see, Pilate therefore said unto them, "Take him yourselves and judge him according to your law." The Jews said unto him, "It is not lawful for us to put any man to death, that the word of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spake, signifying by what manner of death he should die." Notice that last statement. We cannot put Jesus to death. They've already decided what they want to happen. Sentence already in. And that, of course, to fulfill what Jesus had said, and you can read that in Matthew chapter 20, in verse 19, before Jesus came into the city of Jerusalem proper, he told the disciples just exactly what was going to happen. How that he would be delivered to these evil men and that he would be crucified. And on the third day, he would be raised from the dead. And now the statement is made that the things that are transpiring are for the purpose of fulfilling what he said. So here we are. These things are about to take place in accordance with the scriptures. The death sentence, of course, is demanded. As you look at verse 32 and 33, as we've just read, John's account. Now, Randy, you pointed out a while ago from John the 12th chapter that this is the beginning of John's account of the last week of Jesus, and indeed it is. But if you look at verse 32 of that text, verse 32, Jesus said, "And I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men unto myself. But this said he, signifying by what manner of death he should die. The multitude therefore answered him, We have heard out of the law that the Christ abideth forever. How sayest thou, the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man?" Well, now Jesus knew exactly what was taking place, and he knew it wasn't going to be very long. He said, "Yet a little while is the light among you. Walk while you have the light, that darkness overtake you not. And he that walketh in the darkness knoweth not whether he goeth. While you have the light, believe on the light, that ye may become sons of light." So the death sentence is demanded. Jesus knows that his time is very much limited. This is John's account at the beginning of the last week. Now let's look for just a moment at the charges. Linda, you pointed out from Matthew's account that they take the words of Jesus and so construe them as to make him guilty of blasphemy. And indeed, in verse 65 of Matthew's account, it says, "Then the high priest rent his garments, saying, He has spoken blasphemy. What further need have we of witnesses? Behold, now ye have heard the blasphemy." And that's, of course, right after the statement, "I adjure thee," as to put him under some kind of a binding oath. To incriminate himself. "Tell me, are you the Christ, the Son of God?" And Jesus said, "Thou hast said." And so indeed, he is accused of blasphemy. Now, according to the law, if a man blasphemed against God, what was to be the penalty?
Death.
Was to be death. Yeah, killing.
Leviticus chapter, wherever it is on the screen, here it is, 24, verse 16.
Let's go over to Luke's account, where some of the accusations are put together. Luke chapter 23, verse 2. Luke 23, verse 2. Well, verse 1, let's begin there. It says, "The whole company of them arose up and brought him before Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, We found this man perverting our nation, forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ a king." I would suggest to you that when we put the accounts together and we join John's account and Luke's account, we find that Pilate has asked, "What are you accusing this man of?" And Luke here tells us three things. We accuse him of perverting our nation, forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, and that saying he himself is Christ a king. Perverting our nation. Well, how had Jesus done that? How had they even perceived that he had done that?
He didn't bow down to them.
Yeah. No, he didn't bow down to them. But these charges don't take a whole lot of history just to know that they're all trumped up charges. Forbidding to give tribute to Caesar. We've read Matthew's account when the questions were asked, according to Matthew's account. Is it lawful to give tribute to Caesar or not? How would he answer that?
He said, "Give Caesar
a coin." Show me a coin. They showed him a coin. He said, "Whose picture's on the coin?" Well, that's a picture of Caesar. Yeah, okay. So, you give Caesar what's Caesar's, and you give God what's God. How is that forbidding to give tribute to Caesar? Jesus didn't do that.
It was a lie
from the get-go.
Yeah. and then say he is the Christ, a king.
Now let's look at John's account here in John chapter 18. Go back to that if you would please, and look at verse 33. In verse 33, Pilate therefore entered again into the praetorium and called Jesus. Now get the picture. He's come out to talk to the people. And now we have these accusations kind of summed up in, he's an evildoer, we wouldn't have brought him. And then Pilate goes back and speaks to Jesus and asks him, art thou the king of the Jews? And Jesus answered, sayest thou this of thyself, or did others tell it thee concerning me? Maybe it's just me, but I kind of have to smile at some of these statements that the Lord makes on this occasion. Because there is some humor, I think. Maybe it's just my twisted sense of humor. But do you not see that, Pilate, did you dream that up on your own, or do you have to be told? Well, where did this accusation come from? Are you a king? What perception had Jesus presented before Pilate that would indicate he's anything more than just an ordinary man?
Just the accusations.
Just the accusation. Pilate hadn't heard him preach. And so all he's got is this testimony of these Jews saying, well, he said he was a king. All right. Well, did you dream that up on your own, or did somebody have to tell you that that's what I'm charged with? Well, somebody had to tell him, because he had heard nothing to indicate that. And the appearance, obviously, of Jesus, he had identified earlier that, you know, foxes have holes and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has not any place to lay his head. He had nothing. If he was a king, an earthly king, a threat to Caesar or even the governorship of Pilate, wouldn't there be some entourage that would indicate such? But he had nothing. And so here we are. Are you a king? Well, did you figure that out on your own, or did somebody tell you that? And then in verse 35, Pilate answered, am I a Jew? Thine own nation and the chief priests delivered thee unto me. What hast thou done? Well, I had to do something because they said I had, you see. I wouldn't be here if I wasn't guilty of something. That's their argument, isn't it? I'm an evil man because they've charged me with these crimes. Well, read on. Verse 36, more common perhaps in our thinking, Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight, that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from hence. And you've heard that quoted time after time after time, where we talk about the spiritual nature of the Lord's kingdom. It was prophesied to be such, Daniel 2, Daniel 7, he would receive this kingdom when he would ascend to the Ancient of Days. His kingdom was not an earthly kingdom. His kingship was never intended to be an earthly kingship. If it was, he said, then my servants would fight. My kingdom was never intended to be that kind of a kingdom. So he said to this end, verse 37 of John 18. Pilate therefore said unto him, art thou a king then? Jesus answered, thou sayest that I am a king. To this end have I been born. To this end am I come into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice. And Pilate said unto him, what is truth? Now, essentially, that's the end of Pilate's initial investigation as to whether Jesus is guilty of anything or not. And what does Pilate then conclude? You'll see that in verse 38 following. When he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and saith unto them, I find no crime in him. Now this is what you've accused him of, blaspheming. You've accused him of perverting the Jewish nation, forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he's a king. Now what evidence you have? Well, we said he was, or we wouldn't have brought him. Well, that don't do it, does it? Pilate said, I don't find any crime. And he's not guilty of anything. So the charges Pilate acknowledges then are false. And here's the passage that we were quoting from a few moments ago. I find no crime in him. And that's consistent with what we see in Matthew's account. Now, I want to spend just a moment on this chart, or a chart or two just here. In Daniel chapter 2, to this class of people, students, I'll call you that, I believe you're Bible students, but you're familiar with the Old Testament prophecy of Daniel and the setting in which it's found. I do a lot more talking, I think, in classes than I would like to do. Somebody bring me up to speed on Daniel chapter 2. King Nebuchadnezzar has seen something, and he wants to find out what it was all about. He'd had a dream. What was it?
You want to talk about the image?
Yeah.
Well, there's an image in gold is Babylon, and that's the head.
Yeah. Silver. Breast and arms were breast, silver.
And then the bronze.
Yeah.
Was the Greek. And then the iron clay with the feet.
Right.
Was Roman.
So we've got an image that's out of different types of metal. And Daniel explains that image and tells the king Nebuchadnezzar what it meant. We've got a succession of kingdoms, starting with you. And as Donna pointed out, we've got the
dream.
Yeah, this was the dream. And so in the days of the fourth kings, God's going to set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, nor shall the sovereignty thereof be left to another people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these and stand forever. Now, that's important that we understand what Daniel has told him, not only about the establishment of the kingdom, but what this small stone is going to do that was cut out of the mountain is going to smite this image on the feet. What it's going to do, it's going to break in pieces and consume them all. It's going to stand forever. This small stone, who is that?
The Messiah.
The Messiah, yeah. And he would come during the days of the fourth kingdom. Who was that? The Romans. Yeah, and he'd smite it on the feet. He would break it all into pieces. And the Lord's kingdom then would be established, and it would consume all of these others. Now, it's that last expression that I want us to think about just a little bit. It would consume all these others. The Lord's kingdom would be made up of citizens of many different nationalities. In fact, as Isaiah said it, he said, all nations shall flow into it. Many different nationalities will make up the Lord's kingdom. So we're not talking about a geographic boundary. I don't know why the premillennial teacher don't get that. That just is astounding to me that somehow we've got to make the Lord's kingdom earthly with a geographic boundary. How can it be geographic boundary and be made up of citizens of all over the whole globe? How can that be possible? Well, you see, that's the problem. It's really not. But wherever you live on the globe, you can become a part of the Lord's kingdom because it is not limited by geographic boundaries. It's a spiritual kingdom. And you join it or become a part of, join is a poor word, you become a part of it as the Lord adds you through your obedience to the gospel. He adds you as a citizen to his kingdom. Now, that's as simple as I know how to make it. And Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar that this interpretation is absolutely certain. Now, when would it come to pass? In Daniel 7, verses 13 and 14, Daniel said it would happen when the Son of Man, or one like unto a Son of Man, would ascend unto the Ancient of Days. Now, that's simple, brethren. It's really simple. Jesus' kingdom would be established when he would ascend to the Ancient of Days. Not on the earth, when he ascended to the right hand of God. This is what the Apostle Peter is declaring in Acts chapter 2. Well, how could he declare that? In Acts chapter 1, they saw that. They saw him ascend up into the heavens where Jesus claimed that he was seated at the right hand of God. The prophet said that that's where he would be seated. So the nature of his kingdom was to be spiritual in nature. I don't know why that we're so bent on a perfect earth. Had somebody just at the door a week or so ago wanting to know what I thought about what it would be like to live on this perfect earth, this perfect earth. I said, I don't want to live on earth. I want to live in heaven. For, you know, Paul said that if you can see it, it's temporal. If it's temporal, it's not going to last. That's what temporal means. Well, I don't want to live on this perfect earth. It's not perfect, and it's not ever going to be perfect. It's going to be destroyed. I want to be with God and all the redeemed in heaven. I don't want to be on earth. Well, they had other things to do, I'm sure. But when you turn into Daniel's prophecy in Daniel 2, verse 44, and you read in the Hebrew letter in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 28, those of you that are joining us in that study are going to see just how important and impressive that is. Because these Hebrews are wanting to go back and just live as a good Jew. Be a good Jew. Be at peace and don't be in trouble. Just be a good Jew. And the writer is telling them what you have is so much greater than what you could have ever had under the law with the temple sacrifices and the temple priesthood. In fact, he tells them in chapter 12, verse 28, that you're receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken. Now listen carefully to this point. If you have folks knock on your door and they want to talk with you about some kind of a temporal kingdom and living on the earth forever and all this kind of, I want to know something. Maybe you can find it out for me. When Daniel said that when the kingdom of Christ would come, that it would break in pieces all these and stand forever, that's Daniel 2. In Daniel 7, he said, of its dominion there shall be no end. It'll last forever. That's Daniel 7, 13 and 14. These Hebrews were becoming a part of a kingdom which can never be shaken. Can't ever be shaken. If what these Hebrews were becoming a part of is not what Daniel was prophesying about. Now follow this. What would happen to that which the Hebrews were becoming a part of when this would ultimately come? Because you're going to have something that's going to break in pieces all other kingdoms and it's going to stand forever. But you got one over here that these Hebrews were a part of that cannot be shaken. I don't know how to slice that any other way than to come up with the conclusion that if they're not the same, you've got God against God. And maybe you can explain it differently, but I don't know how else to understand that. These Hebrews were becoming a part of what Daniel prophesied about, the Lord's kingdom. It was everlasting in its nature. So why would they want to go back and become a part of something temporal and just be a good Jew and offer animal sacrifices and go back and live under the law? Well, you've become a part of the very thing that the Old Testament prophets were pointing to. So appreciate it. And you have that opportunity too, right along with them, to become a part of this that these Hebrews were becoming a part of. Jesus disclaimed any kind of a notion that he had ever come to establish an earthly entity or an earthly empire. My kingdom is not of this world. The Lord's kingdom is composed of such things as righteousness, sanctification, these spiritual qualities that you see in Romans 14 and these other passages. It's not eating and drinking. It's not something that's physical in nature. Never was intended to be. But how many people do you talk to about spiritual matters that have some kind of a conception of a perfect world and we're going to live on earth? You ever talk to folks like that? The Bible don't address that. It just don't address that. And you've got to twist and pervert all kinds of passages, beating square pegs into round holes to make that fit. It just won't fit, not with the Scriptures. So this is what we want to see, the nature of the Lord's kingdom. Are you a king then? No, my kingdom was never intended to be a physical kingdom. But it won't be long. I'll be seated at the right hand of God in heaven. That's the kind of king that he was promised to be. All right, any questions or comments just here? Yes?
Just like you don't want to be on earth, they do.
I know it. And why? Why do you want to be on earth? I don't know. We get our minds so involved in something that's physical, we can't even think about something better than that, right?
I already told you this, but they came to my door last week, and we had a short conversation at the front porch. And I said, you know, looking forward to living in heaven forever. And he said, I don't want to live in heaven. And I said, you don't? No. I want to live on a perfect earth.
Yes. Why?
Well, that's the thing is, he's swallowed a lie.
Well, more truth to that than maybe you realize.
Yeah.
They believe that the 144,000 as they're already gone. So you didn't get one of the earlier tickets. I like the way that you expressed that. Yeah, they claim that the 144,000 are in heaven, and they're not going to be
here. When he says, "I don't want to live in heaven."
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, yeah. Strangely enough, the Apostle Paul said that's where he wanted to go, and he described the one hope in Colossians chapter 1, verse 5, as being the hope of heaven. We have one hope, not multiple hopes. Now, I'm not, mathematics is not my best subject, I get it. But I think I can get one plus one. That's two hopes. Now, if there's some that want to live on earth, and others going to live in heaven, that's two hopes. Paul said there's one. And he tells us what it is. Yeah. Well, no offense intended, but you're getting a new one part by part and piece by piece. Just a little bit at a time, okay? All right. Let's talk about Herod. As we look back at the text, maybe that's where I need to be looking, maybe instead of parts by parts. But let's go back to verse 6 will be a good start for us. But verse 6, Luke 23, verse 6. Yeah, Luke 23, verse 6. Yes, verse 6. It says, but when Pilate heard it, he asked whether the man were a Galilean. And when he knew that he was of Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him unto Herod, who himself also was at Jerusalem in those days. Now, we know already that Pilate was not a Jew. He's asked that question, am I a Jew? No, he wasn't a Jew. Now, when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceeding glad, for he was of a long time desirous to see him, because he had heard concerning him, and he hoped to see some miracle done by him. And he questioned him in many words, but he answered him nothing. And the chief priests and scribes stood vehemently accusing him. And Herod, with his soldiers, set him at naught and mocked him and arrayed him in a gorgeous apparel, sent him back to Pilate. And Herod and Pilate became friends with each other that very day, for before they were at enmity between themselves. Now, Herod has essentially got the same kind of role or position that Pilate has. And we want to talk more about Herod, and we'll just start with this chart, if I can remember to do that. Start with this chart, and we'll start to talk about Herod. Those of you that were in our history and geography study, you may want to go back. I think I passed out some charts about the Herodian dynasty. And to know who this man is, that Jesus appears before, is really quite interesting. So if you have those notes, if not, we'll try to do something about that, so that you can know who this man is. He's not a good fellow either. So Jesus got kind of the cream of the crop to run the Roman end of the trial. We'll talk more about that next week. Thank you for your comments. Very kind attention.